Macmillan Audio presents Stories I Only Tell My Friends, written and read by Rob Lowe. To Cheryl, Matthew, and John Owen. You make my life worth living, and to the memory of my mother, Barbara. Chapter 1. I had always had an affinity for him, an admiration for his easy grace, his natural charisma, despite the fact that for the better part of a decade, my then-girlfriend kept a picture of him running shirtless through Central Park on her refrigerator door. Maybe my lack of jealousy towards this particular pinup was tamped down by empathy for his loss of his father and an appreciation for how complicated it is to be the subject of curiosity and objectification from a very young age. That said, when my girlfriend and others would constantly swoon over him, when I would see him continually splashed across the newspapers, resplendent like an American prince, I wasn't above the occasional male thought of, screw that guy. As a person navigating the waters of public scrutiny, you are often unable to hold on to your personal heroes or villains. Inevitably, you will meet your hero, and he may turn out to be less than impressive, while your villain turns out to be the coolest cat you've ever met. You never can tell, so eventually you learn to live without the rooting interest in the parade of stars, musicians, sports champions, and politicians. And you lose the ability to participate in the real American pastime, beating up on people you don't like, and glorifying people you do. I had not yet learned that truism when he and I first met. I was at the point where I was deeply unhappy with my personal life, increasingly frustrated about where my career seemed to be going, although from the outside it would probably appear to anyone observing that I was among the most blessed 24-year-olds on the planet. And in an effort to find substance, meaning, and excitement, I had become deeply involved in the world of politics. It was at one of these political events, the kind where movie stars mix with political stars, each trading in each other's reflective glory, both looking to have the other fill something missing inside of them, that we were introduced. Rob Lowe, I'd like you to meet John Kennedy Jr., someone said. Hey man, good to meet you, I said. He smiled. We shook hands, and I was relieved that my then ex-girlfriend wasn't there to notice that he was slightly taller than I was, or to comment on who had better looking hair. We made some small talk, and I remember thinking, how does he do it? How does he carry the scrutiny? How does he attempt a normal life? Is it even possible? Is it even worth trying? He was charming and gracious, and didn't seem to be unnerved by the multitudes of eyeballs stealing glances as we spoke. Eventually, as we were both single guys in our 20s, the talk turned to girls. Maybe we should get out of here. Go find where the action is, he said. I looked at him. Dude, you're fucking JFK Jr., all right? You don't need to go anywhere. He looked at me and laughed. And as he did, I saw a glimpse of his father and was reminded of his family's legacy of sacrifice and tragedy, and was glad that he was carrying the mantle so well and with so much promise for the future. Eventually, we went our separate ways, never teaming up to hunt down any fun that night, although I did later wrestle open a wet bar at 2 a.m. with a vice presidential shortlist candidate. Over the years, I watched him navigate the currents of fame, dating, career ups and downs, curious to see how his life would play out. Sometimes he and I would both appear on those shameful lists of hunks. Can there be a more degrading or frankly gross word than hunk? Hunk of what? Hunk of wood? Hunk of cheese? Yikes. There may have even been a girl or two whom we both coveted, but that was the extent of my contact with him. In the late 90s, my wife Cheryl and I were on a romantic ski vacation in Sun Valley, Idaho. We still felt like newlyweds, in spite of having two beautiful baby boys, from whom we'd escaped for a rare evening out. Sun Valley is one of my favorite spots. It's old school, as the site of North America's first chairlift, glamorous, the home of Hemingway and early Hollywood royalty, and boasts one of the greatest ski mountains in the country. I'd been going there since the mid-1980s, and had always liked the mix of people you might encounter at any given time. One evening at a big holiday party, I felt a tap on the shoulder. It was John Jr. "How've you been, man?" he asked with a smile. I introduced him to Cheryl. He congratulated us on our recent marriage. After a while, Cheryl went off on her own, leaving the two of us alone in the corner, watching the party move on around us. Even in this more rarefied crowd, you could feel the occasional glare of curious observation. A ski instructor passed by, a movie star, a local ski bunny brushed by John and flipped her hair. "How do you do it?" he asked, so low against the buzz of the party that I couldn't quite hear. "I'm sorry? How do you do it?" he repeated. "I mean, how did you settle down? You, of all people." I looked at him and he was smiling, almost laughing, as if covering something else, some other emotion I couldn't quite discern. At first I thought he might be gently poking fun at me. Up until my marriage, my life had been publicly marked by a fair number of romances, some covered with great interest in the papers. But I saw that his question was real, and that he seemed to be grappling with some sort of puzzle he could not solve. I realized he was looking across the room to a willowy blonde. She had fantastic blue eyes, the kind of beauty and magnetism that was usually reserved for film stars. She was standing next to my wife, Cheryl, also a blue-eyed blonde, with a beauty and presence that made her seem as if a spotlight and wind machine were constantly trained on her. I put two and two together. "Looks like you have a great girl. And that's half the battle right there. She's obviously amazing, and if she's your best friend, marry her. You can do it. Don't let anyone tell you you can't, that you're not ready or not capable. Come on in, man. The water's warm. I'm here to tell you it is. If she's your friend, in addition to all the other stuff, pull the trigger. Don't let her get away. You never know what life will bring." I think he was a little taken aback by the passion of my response. I'm not at all sure what he had expected me to say. But he asked, so what the hell? John nodded, and we went on to other topics. The next day, we met to ski on the mountain. He snowboarded, ripping down the face fast and free. But the weather was turning, and a whiteout was upon us. In the snow and speed and the wind, we were separated. I looked up over the ridge, and he was gone, lost in the clouds. John did marry his blonde, his Carolyn. I was glad for him, and thought about sending him a note, but somehow I didn't. Of all my character flaws, and there are a number of them, procrastination is my most distinctive. Instead, I wished him luck, children, and the longevity of love with one of my non-alcoholic beers as I watched the coverage on Entertainment Tonight. As a huge political junkie and unabashed admirer of our country, I was a huge fan of his brainchild, George Magazine. When someone finally stopped asking celebrities appearing on its cover to pose in those George Washington wigs, I thought, okay, they're rolling now. The end of the century approached. The 90s were a time of building for me. Building a life that was sober, drained of harmful, wasteful excesses, and manufacturing in its place a family of my own. This was my priority through the decade, and that work continues to pay off today with the love of my sons, Matthew and John Owen, and the constant gift of the love of my wife, Cheryl. Where the 80s had been about building a career, the 90s ended with my having built a life. By the end of the decade, my career was very much in flux, just as it had been at the end of the previous one. I had had some successes in the 90s, always made money, but the truth was I was like a man pushing a boulder up a hill, a huge, heavy, difficult boulder made up of some career mistakes, projects that didn't meet expectations, and 20 years of being a known quantity. And not only not being a new sensation, but something worse. Being someone people in Hollywood took for granted, someone with no surprises left in him. For example, the ability to appear on a cover of a magazine is critical for any major actor. It's just a fact of the business end of show business. And I hadn't been on the cover of a magazine in almost 10 years. To have the kind of career one aspires to, comprising good, major work over the course of a lifetime, it was critical that I find two things. The breakout watershed project to remind people what I could accomplish as an actor, and that first magazine cover and profile to publicize it. It was June of 1999, and John Kennedy Jr. was about to help me get both. My longtime publicist, Alan Yerob, was on the line. "Apparently, JFK Jr. stood up in today's staff meeting and said he'd just seen a pilot for a new TV series that was the embodiment of everything he founded George Magazine to be. He was emotional about it, very moved by the show, and inspired to help people hear about it. He thinks The West Wing can be one of those once-in-a-lifetime shows that can change people's lives. Your character of Sam Seaborn was his favorite, and he wants to put you on George's September cover. Although the advanced copy of The West Wing had been receiving freakishly unanimous raves, I was ecstatic and humbled by this particular endorsement. It's impossible to imagine living JFK Jr.'s life and then watching a show whose central theme was the heart and soul of the American presidency. His whole world had been shaped by the office, the service to it, and the tragic sacrifice in its name. The West Wing was going to be about the best and brightest. His father's administration all but coined the phrase. Alan, does John realize that there's no guarantee that this show will last very long? I knew that George was in serious financial trouble and could ill afford to feature a show with a high likelihood of attaining the ultimate creative Pyrrhic victory, worshipped by the critics and ignored by the public. If the show was quickly canceled, and quite a few thought it would be, it would be a financial disaster for John and possibly could be the end of the magazine. Rob, Alan said, John's putting you on the cover. He couldn't care less. The politics of the workplace can be complicated, Machiavellian, self-serving, and just downright stupid no matter where you work. My grandpa ran a restaurant in Ohio for 50 years. I'm sure every now and then he would get nervous when his most popular car hop got uppity and started wanting better hours. My father practices law to this day and deals with those who smile to his face, then wish he would step on a limpet mine in the middle of Ludlow Street. That's just the way of the world. It's just worse in Hollywood. Someone somewhere got it into their heads that it would be a bad thing for the launch of our new show if I was on the cover of George. It was made very clear to me that I had no right to be on this cover and that John should rescind the offer. When pushed for a reason as to why it would be a bad thing for a show no one had ever heard of to get this kind of recognition, the response was, everyone should be on the cover, not you. I understood that there was no single star of the show, but still thought it was a great opportunity for all concerned. The higher-ups remained adamant, and they asked John to take me off the cover. He refused. As I puzzled over and was hurt by this disconnect between me and my new bosses on the West Wing, John was in New York planning the cover shoot. He chose Platon, one of the great photographers, and lined up the journalist for the profile. After it was clear that John made his own choices on his covers and could not be pushed around, the folks at the West Wing backed down and allowed an on-set visit and an additional article about the show, cast, and writers to be written. John wanted to throw a party for me in New York to coincide with the magazine's release and the premiere of the show. I made plans to attend and thank him for supporting me at a time when no one else had. I picked up the phone and called his offices and got an assistant. He just came out of his last meeting on your cover, and he's running a little late for the airport. Can he call you Monday? No problem, I said. We'll talk then. I hung up and started preparing for Monday's table reading of the first episode of The West Wing. John hopped into his car. He was rushing to meet Carolyn and her sister Lauren, eager to get to the airport to fly them to his cousin Rory's wedding. It was a hazy summer evening, the kind we remember from childhood. He was probably excited. He was going back to his family. He was going home. It's been my experience that when a phone call wakes you, it's never good news. I had taken a small cottage in Burbank, a few blocks away from the studio, for late nights, and was asleep when I got the call. It was Cheryl, and I could tell she was upset. She wanted me to turn on the news. At first, it seemed like it couldn't possibly be happening. Clearly, these reporters had it wrong. John, his beloved wife and sister, would surely be found in an embarrassing mix-up or miscommunication. They could not be gone. No one is that cruel. No God can ask that of a family. No one could so much as imagine the possibility of the horrific and arbitrary sudden nature of fate. Search teams were scrambled. Like most Americans, I said a prayer of hope. Monday came. The search for John, Carolyn, and Lauren continued. At the studio, the cast and producers gathered for the very first table reading of The West Wing. I stood and told the group how much John admired the show and asked that we pray for him and work with his inspiration. It was very quiet. People were numb. Later, there was talk of canceling the cover shoot, now just days away. I was devastated and in no mood for it. But John's editors insisted, pointing out that John's last editorial decision was to make this happen. It was what he wanted. By Tuesday, the worst had been confirmed. The plane had been found. There were no survivors. John, Carolyn, and Lauren were gone. I heard the news on my way to the photo session. Being on the Oval Office set is very moving. It's an exact replica of the Clinton version, down to the artwork on the walls and the fabric on the couches. It was designed by the amazing movie production designer John Huttman, who does all of Robert Redford's movies, and whom I've known since he was Jodie Foster's roommate at Yale. It is so realistic that when I later found myself in the actual Oval Office, I felt as if it was just another day at the office. I was, however, fascinated with the one thing the real Oval Office has that ours did not, and that was a ceiling. I stood looking up at it, staring like an idiot, while everybody else oohed and aahed over the amazing historical pieces that fill the room. However, it's not the authenticity that takes your breath away when you step onto that soundstage at Warner Brothers Studios. It is the solemnity of history, of destiny, and of fate. You are certain that you are actually in the room where power, patriotism, faith, and the ability to change the world, and the specter of both success and tragedy, flow like tangible, unbridled currents. You feel the presence of the men who navigated them as they created our collective American history, and you fully realize that they are not disembodied images on the nightly news, or unknowable titans or partisan figureheads to be applauded or ridiculed. You feel as if you are standing where they stood. You can open their desk drawers, sit in their seat, and dial their phone. They are somehow more real to you now. They are not the sum of their successes or failures. They are human beings. Presidents get to redesign the Oval Office to their own tastes, and they have the National Gallery, Smithsonian, and National Archive warehouses of priceless pieces to choose from. John Jr.'s mother knew her way around a swatch or two, so she made sure her husband's Oval Office was simple and chic, but with enough plausible deniability if called out for it, and with the proper nod to history. For the president's desk, she chose the Resolute desk, fashioned from the timbers of the HMS Resolute, found abandoned by an American vessel and returned to England, where Queen Victoria later had the timbers made into a desk and sent to President Rutherford B. Hayes as a goodwill gesture. FDR also loved the desk, but insisted that a modesty panel be installed to swing closed at the front in order to prevent people from seeing his leg braces while he sat. Years later, as JFK attended to the nation's business, Tiny John Jr. would famously be photographed impishly peeking out from behind the desk's panel. I am leaning against a replica of that desk now, the flash of the photographer's strobe jolting me, illuminating the darkened soundstage, cutting the tension and sadness of the George cover shoot. A number of staff have flown in from New York. John was more than a boss to them, and obviously they are devastated. They share stories of John's life. Some cry, but all soldier on through this melancholy and bizarre photo shoot in the Oval Office set. Platon, the great photographer, asks me to embody strength, dignity, and power. He's asking me to focus on his lens, to bring the sparkle that sells magazines. But my thoughts are elsewhere. I'm thinking of how unexpected and yet oddly preordained life can be. Events are upon you in an instant, unforeseen and without warning, and oftentimes marked by disappointment and tragedy, but equally often leading to a better understanding of the bittersweet truth of life. A father is taken from his son, a promise is unfulfilled, and then the son is reunited with him, also in an instant, and under the cover of sadness. A theme continues in that unique, awful beauty that marks our human experience. The flash explodes in my face again. I put on a smile, none of these shots will ever be used, and remind myself that John's journey is over, and, with some thanks to him, a new journey for me is ahead. I never knew him well. Many Americans also felt a connection to him without knowing him at all. In some ways, he was America's son. I will always be moved by John Kennedy Jr.'s steadiness in the harsh, unrelenting spotlight, his quest for personal identity and substance, and for going his own way and building a life of his choosing. I will always remember his support and kindness to me, and be grateful to him for being among the first to recognize that with my next project, The West Wing, I just might be part of something great. Chapter 2. My mother awakens me. She's worked up, highly strung. She's pulling me out of bed from a deep sleep. I'm scared. It feels like it's the middle of the night, although in a weird example of the capabilities of our modern age, a quick Google search today tells me it was probably just about 10:15 p.m. "Robbie, wake up. It's important," she urges. She has tears in her eyes. Quickly, I'm placed into my footsie pajamas and she hustles me downstairs. My baby brother is asleep. If my dad is home, he's not awake. It's just the two of us. Coming down the stairs, I see the glow of the television, her favorite blanket on the couch. She must have been watching TV right before she rushed upstairs to wake me. I'm groggy and confused as she sits me next to her in front of the eerie gray light of our Zenith black and white television. She takes my hand, and I notice it's shaking. I try to make out the images on the television screen, but they are fuzzy and garbled. My mom is hugging me now, as I finally begin to make out some clarity in the picture. "We copy you down, Eagle," a man is saying. A slight gasp from my mother as, on television, a fellow Ohioan is saying, "Engine arm is off. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed." Within moments, Neil Armstrong of Wapakoneta, Ohio, 20 miles from my grandparents' house, sets foot on the moon. It seems at once fake, being woken up from a dream, which I was, and yet of dramatic importance, even to a 4.5-year-old. I look at my mom. She has tears running down her face. "Nothing will ever be the same," she whispers. My mother was right. The world did change. Soon after, I lost my father. He wasn't taken from us in heroic, tragic fashion. In fact, he wasn't even dead. But when there is suddenly that emptiness in your home and in your heart, the loss feels very similar to death. Like most boys, I idolized my father, even as a 4-year-old. He was movie star handsome, a cross between Paul Newman and a Godfather-era Jimmy Caan. Like the latter, he had a way with the ladies. Like the former, he was a product of the Midwest of the 1950s, set in its ways, cloistered, and with a premium on politeness and not rocking the boat to get your true needs met. He was athletic and strong, a champion tennis player in an era when few had yet discovered the sport. My earliest memory may be of him sawing his wooden Jack Kramer racket in half at the handle so we could hit together, even though I was substantially shorter than the tennis net. He and my mother were pinned in college at DePauw, true school sweethearts. My mother was an English major and boasted William Faulkner as one of her guest professors. She was bookish and beautiful, from a small town in Ohio. Her father was the archetypal self-made man. The youngest of 9 children, he left home at 11 years old to escape his family's grinding poverty. Starting as a butcher's apprentice, my grandfather eventually worked his way up to owning the entire grocery store, parlaying that into 2 successful restaurants. By the time my mother was a little girl, her dad was the only man who could afford a Cadillac in all of Shelby County, Ohio. And so she was raised in nouveau privilege, a sheltered world where only good things happened and where life clearly rewarded those with the proper intentions. With her arresting beauty, she not only looked like a princess, she was treated like one. My father, on the other hand, was from Indiana, a place of hard-nosed pragmatism. He loved to fight, to brawl, a trait that served him well as a 4'11" high school freshman, and less so as a 5'9" newlywed. But together, they made a handsome couple and were married on the eve of my father's departure to law school at the University of Virginia. What makes the equation of man and woman so eternally mysterious, glorious, and explosive? It almost seems as if each decade has its own unique battle of the sexes. The field of conflict is ever-changing, as are the players. But the carnage and confusion are always fueled by the enduring quest of sex, love, and emotional fulfillment. This list in varying order, according to experience and gender. In the 80s, we navigated the legacy of the then decades-old free love movement, as well as a status-seeking ethos powered by booze and coke, and a vague sense that this sexual smorgasbord wouldn't and shouldn't last forever. And with the arrival of AIDS, it did not. My mom and dad faced different challenges. They wanted to escape the uniformity and banal conventions of the 1950s, but didn't have the roadmap later created by the upheavals of the late 60s. On a practical level, sex was still the domain of married couples only, in theory, and the pill didn't exist. Indeed, on their wedding night, both my parents were virgins. On the first night of their honeymoon, as my mother fought an anxiety attack waiting in the hotel room, my dad escaped to the hotel pool, avoiding the inevitable by swimming lap after lap after lap. and I wonder why, whenever I'm stressed, I head to the water. At some point, however, they must have figured it out, because on March 17, 1964, I was born at the University Hospital in Charlottesville, Virginia. For the then standard 3 days of my mother's hospital stay, my father was forbidden to hold or touch me. As my mother and I bonded, my father and I remained separated by the glass of the observation window, looking at each other across the distance, the first notes in a theme that would be played out for the rest of our lives. When I was 6 months old, my dad graduated from law school and we left Charlottesville for Dayton, Ohio. Later in life, as my love of history, of tradition, politics, and government became a constant, I began to wonder if I wasn't imbued with this passion by virtue of being born in the town that Mr. Jefferson built. My parents chose Dayton because it was then a bustling, growing city, home to a number of major businesses, including National Cash Register, Dayton Tire, AC Delco, and Mead Paper. We moved into a nice 3-bedroom home, whose floor plan I can still remember, in a leafy suburb. My dad joined a law practice. My mother gave up her job as a high school English teacher and stayed home to raise me. They were the quintessential young, upwardly mobile Midwestern couple of the mid-60s. They discovered fondue, the cast album of Camelot, and gin and tonics. Later, it would be Jesus Christ Superstar and pot. They had a close circle of like-minded friends. According to family lore, at one of these fondue parties, thrown by my parents to introduce a young dentist to their circle of friends, my mother's naivete was unveiled for all to see in a fashion that seems almost impossible today. Attempting to drum up new business for the dentist, she told a hushed room that she loved going to his office because he was so gentle when he put his prick in my mouth. She went on with enthusiasm to recount how she never felt scared when he puts his prick in, and that sometimes it feels good. My father, by then likely more well-versed in such matters, burst out laughing in the horrified silence, simultaneously enraging and confusing my mom. What did I say? Barbara. What? I'm just talking about his prick and... Barbara. He began to explain, but gave up as she looked at him with a mixture of blithe indulgence and dawning reproach of what was clearly a deviant mind. Meanwhile, my dad and every single other fondue eater present swallowed their laughter and attempted to steer the evening back on track. To me, this snapshot of their early marriage is revealing. My mother and father were moving in different currents towards different worldviews, so much so that when I was old enough to have such thoughts, I couldn't imagine that they had ever had anything in common. But they were becoming themselves, and over time, this meant they were becoming increasingly dissimilar. Dad crystallizing into a dashing, successful, gregarious, hot-headed up-and-comer, and Mom becoming an earnest, thoughtful teacher, always slightly off the public frequency, beginning to occupy her solitary spot outside conventional wisdom and custom. There were other warning signs that all was not well with them, but I was far too young to be aware. Claw hammers were thrown, lipstick was found in places it shouldn't be, and the painful, cliched narrative of being married too young to someone you don't really know because they don't know themselves headed towards its climax. My dad started working late. My mom and I spent more and more time at my grandparents' without my dad, and it became normal that my dad's presence in the house was minimal. One day when I was 4 years old, my mom told me I would be having a brother. Looking back, I might have assumed as much, as the third bedroom had been redone in a Dumbo the Flying Elephant motif. I'm going to name him Chad, she said. And I remember thinking that the name Chad reminded me of the word chapstick. I didn't get it, and I asked her to reconsider the name. Invoking her parental prerogative of not having to explain herself to her 4-year-old son, she told me that the matter was closed. My brother was born on January 15, 1968. I have no memory of Chad's birth, although I know my dad fainted dead away when he was told about it in the waiting room. Apparently, not letting him hold his newborn had some wisdom to it after all. Baby Chad came home. My father did not. At least, that is the assumption, as he is absent from my memories of this time. But these recollections are fuzzy and likely distorted. I believe it's not because I was so young as much as it is because the house was so filled with unhappiness, my mother's, my father's, and as a result, my own. I had already begun to tune out reality, to retreat to a private world and block out any pain. From this period of my life, I have only two distinct memories. Both events are irreplicable, impossible to experience more than once in a lifetime, a stopping of time after which nothing will ever be as it was. One is my mother waking me up for the moon landing. The other memory has played out in my mind again and again over the course of my lifetime. I knew the moment it happened that all I had known was over. It has taken 43 years to begin to understand the ripples that have emanated from that day. The shattering, dull wounding, the mistaken lessons, and also the circuitous road that opened up on that day, leading me to eventual happiness and fulfillment that would have been impossible to achieve otherwise. Again, it's just my mom and I. I'm 5 years old. Chad is not there, and I am waiting for my mother to finish her errand at the lumber store. It's a big place, brightly lit, with giant stacks of 2x4s and other cuts of wood all in rows, one after another. I'm sitting on one of these big stacks watching my mother at the cashier. I'm sipping chocolate milk through a straw. It's summer, and even though I'm wearing shorts, it's hot and humid in the giant store, and I'm restless. I'm also thinking that there's been something bothering me. I've been sad and uncomfortable, anxious now, for a while. When the feelings well up, I push them down, lose myself in make-believe, play, cartoons, toys. I can't name this thing that's bothering me. I'm not old enough to know that I should even try. And today, in the sticky Dayton summer, it's upon me again, this unease, this feeling of something bad about to happen. Usually, chocolate milk from Mom can make it go away. Today it won't. I'm watching my mom walking towards me. Later in life, her hair will turn brown, but now she is still blonde, with a perfectly shaped nose, clear blue eyes. She seems tiny in this giant store, alone. Inside me, something clicks. I see our life together very clearly, for all it is, and not what I want it to be. Everything falls away, all other thoughts, all other feelings, just a question forming now, for the first time, triggered by my mom walking towards me in a lumber store. She looks at me and smiles, and I blurt out, "Is Dad ever coming home?" My mom pauses for just a moment, then answers, "No, he isn't. We're getting a divorce." I have spent my career on high alert to cliches, excising them from scripts and speeches whenever I could. I'm deeply suspicious and rarely entertained by conventionally accepted turning points in a plot of events that are meant to seem earth-shatteringly dramatic when, in fact, to me, they are merely predictable. There is no horrier cliche than a child's psyche rocked by divorce. And for much of my life, I have not only resisted this notion, but have had a sort of vague disdain for anyone who pinned their adolescent or adult challenges on their parents' broken lives. To do so is to substitute another's life mistakes for your own. And so, later in life, as I came to face my own shortcomings, I rarely considered the effect of a lost father on a 4-year-old boy. That understanding would only come later, when I confronted my alcoholism, and more clearly, when I had 2 sons of my own. Anything painful surrounding my parents' breakup, I sealed off and buried, left unexplored and undisturbed, like nuclear waste. My mother was unprepared for my reaction to her unvarnished, truthful answer. At the mention of divorce, my body felt as if I'd been shot, shot full of terrible stomach ache and swirling, spinning, out-of-control desolation. I began to cry. Clerks and customers passed us by, oblivious, before my mom hustled me outside as I began to deteriorate. "Do you know what divorce is?" she stammered, and I remember thinking, "You idiot, what do you take me for, a kid?" "Of course I do," I snapped. "I watch Divorce Court." By the time we reached our navy blue station wagon, I was inconsolable. All I wanted was my dad. In the onrushing, awful vision of a life without him, I was confused and scared. When would I see him again? Would I ever see him again? And if so, for how long and under what circumstances? I told my mother I wanted to see him now. It must have been the weekend, because the first place we looked for him were the tennis courts. I can take you today on a tour of all of Dayton's various tennis facilities. This terrible pilgrimage is so etched in my mind. As I sat desperately looking out the window, hoping to see him on a court, in a passing car or on the street, I thought to myself bitterly, "That's what I get for asking the question." And with that, I began to plot how to avoid any similar pain for the rest of my life. To avoid being emotionally bushwhacked on any level whatsoever. And somewhere in my unconscious, I vowed to never ask a question if there was any possibility of a painful or even uncomfortable answer, and to disassociate from all conflict. I began a life of avoidance of potential disharmony at all cost. Unknowingly, I set out down a road that would cost me dearly. I never did find my father that day. Chapter 3. I want to French you. You want to what me? French you? I want to French you. I'm sitting underneath a stage platform in the dark with a very cute girl dressed in a jitterbug costume. We are rehearsing a community theater rendition of The Wizard of Oz. I'm about 10 years old. She's 13. What do you mean, French me? It's a kiss. Don't you know that? I nod earnestly, but I have no idea what she's talking about. I do know she's older and makes a very pretty jitterbug. But Frenching is not in my vocabulary, and I'm petrified of what is clearly about to go down. I think American is better, I say. But Julie the Jitterbug is having none of my dithering, and she promptly proceeds to stick her tongue down my throat. Holy shit, I think, almost gagging. What is she doing? She's wiggling it around in my mouth, and I'm horrified and intrigued all at once. I've never had a kiss of any consequence, and now I'm getting a mouth probe here in the darkness of the Dayton Community Theater. If I hadn't fully grasped the sexy, subversive allure of the theater until then, this little vixen, smelling of perfume and grease paint, has put me immediately on the path of greater understanding. After a moment, I gain my sea legs. You're cute, she says, finally taking a break. I take that to mean that our rendezvous is over. I mumble some excuse and climb out from under the platform and make my scheduled entrance as coroner of the Munchkin City. I'm way too young to appreciate the timing of my opening line. As coroner, I must aver, I thoroughly examined her. A few weeks earlier, my mom and her new husband, Bill, had taken me to see a friend of theirs in a production of Oliver. It was a transformational experience. I watched kids my own age playing the orphans and was knocked cold. It would have made a great scene in a terrible Disney movie. A young boy sits in a darkened theater and is thunderstruck with a vision of his life, of his destiny, and in an instant, he discovers his passion. Some kids hear the Beatles for the first time and are set on the road to rock stardom. My trip to Hollywood began with a, probably bad, local production of Oliver. I was still flush with excitement, giddy, as we walked through the lobby afterward. On the wall, I saw a sign-up sheet for The Wizard of Oz and asked my mom to sign me up. She and Bill looked at each other. Why not? They had no way of knowing how deeply affected I'd been, how electrified I was by the age-old connection of actors, material, and audience. The control, the power the actors seemed to possess while illuminated in their spotlights. And when they reached out to the people in the seats, they were heard, they were understood, and the alchemy of the theater experience transported all bystanders out of the various pressures of their daily lives. Next time I would be up there. That was a club I wanted to belong to. My parents' divorce finalized, my mother had married Bill, and my dad was around for weekends of movies, pizza, and adventures exploring the woods. Our lives seemed to be stabilizing into a new, pretty good routine. But then Bill's job required that we move into Dayton city limits proper, out of the leafy, bucolic suburbs. Bill was a profoundly principled, decent man with a deep interest in social justice and politics. He was the guy driving the VW Bug and listening to left-leaning talk radio as far back as 1970. He believed strongly in diversity, had an inveterate suspicion for the status quo and suburbia in general. As a result, he moved us to North Dayton, then an area of tough economic circumstances, populated by proud, rough, gigantic Irish families who were always on guard to any encroachment of the African-American community that surrounded them. The racial tensions were thick in my new neighborhood, and things were getting worse every year. It was culture shock. Until I enrolled at Van Cleve Elementary School for the second grade, I had never met kids who had no parents at home, had never heard the term food stamps, or seen people beaten to a pulp on the playground for a quarter. Black or white, everybody was completely unlike anybody I had ever encountered. This exposure was all part of Bill's design for equality and enlightenment. And I might have been more interested in these ideas if I hadn't been so busy avoiding getting my ass kicked on a daily basis. My newfound passion for acting wasn't helping matters. This was Dayton, Ohio, 1972, not Beverly Hills, 1982. There was no People magazine yet, no Us Weekly, no Entertainment Tonight, no MTV, no Disney Channel, no Nickelodeon, or E! Channel. In Hollywood, there was zero premium placed on youthful actors other than one-offs, like Tatum O'Neill or David Cassidy. With the exception of forerunners like The Brady Bunch, movies and television were the exclusive domain of stories about adults, acted by adults. Kid actors played the children of the stars, passing in and out of a few scenes if they were lucky. In other words, the modern entertainment industry, in which that scenario would be forever inverted, had yet to be created. The notion that some kid from Ohio could become a successful child actor was ridiculous on its face, particularly to the kids of North Dayton. It was another reason I was different, another reason I felt alone, not to mention the constant source of misunderstandings, hurt feelings, and more than a few fights. But it was a small price to pay for having an interest that consumed my imagination. I tried out, I hadn't yet heard of the phrase audition, for any part at the community playhouse, local traveling, repertory theater, college plays, you name it. It made me feel like my life had direction, that I was no longer adrift in the pain and uncertainty of divorce and a bitter move to a tough neighborhood. On stage, I felt a confidence and a sense of accomplishment I rarely felt anywhere else. If I happened to be in a production with other kids, though, I could tell I was different. They were in the play to have fun and to do well, for sure, but it could just as easily have been a little league team or a summer camp project to them. I had fun too, but I looked at every play as a step on a ladder that would lead me to my future. I was just too young and unsophisticated to know what that future would look like or how to get it. My heart is pounding. I'm trying to calm my nerves by telling myself this is how real actors do it every day of their lives, but I'm only 11, and I've never had a professional audition before. My mom and I are driving up to Columbus so that I can take part in a statewide tryout for the Midwest's biggest traveling summer stock circuit, the Kenley Players. I may even get to meet John Kenley himself, the legendary owner-producer who brings some of Hollywood's top stars to a circuit that includes Dayton, Cincinnati, Columbus, Warren, Ohio, and Flint, Michigan. To me, it's the height of the theatrical world to see Sandy Duncan in Peter Pan, Shirley Jones from The Partridge Family doing On a Clear Day You Can See Forever, or Dom DeLuise in Under the Yum Yum Tree, when they play the huge 1,500-seat memorial halls for a week in each city. At the hotel in Columbus, I stand with about 45 other kids. They are all holding 8x10 photos of themselves. I have no pictures, and I'm embarrassed. Clearly, these kids are pros. A man wearing eyeliner asks us to do some rudimentary dance moves. I am fixated. Why would a man wear eyeliner?
1, 2, kickball change, he shrieks at us.
I don't know what he's talking about. Kickball change, kick what ball? All around me, kids are pirouetting, spinning like tops. I'm lost. My mom is nowhere to be found. She thinks it's important that I find my own way, so she is not among the lineup of other mothers holding their kids' photos, combs, and hairspray. Next comes the singing. A 12-year-old belts out Gary Indiana from The Music Man, complete with fantastic lisp. Later, when I talk to him, I realize the lisp is real. I get cold feet and decide to shit-can my bold choice to do Where Is Love from Oliver, and instead fall back on my go-to musical audition piece, Happy Birthday. I get through it fairly well, and am immediately led to a large oak door. Where are you taking me? To meet Mr. Kenley. I feel like I'm going to see the wizard. The minion ushers me into a huge suite. I've never been in a hotel room this big. There's a dining room table in it. A man rises from the couch and comes to greet me. Hello, son, I'm John Kenley. Mr. Kenley appears to be wearing white face and red lipstick like Cesar Romero as the Joker from Batman. He looks anywhere from 80 to 180 years old. So, you want to be an actor? Yes, sir, I manage. Well, we always need local actors, and I hear you are getting a lot of experience in Dayton. You are in a song and dance group, is that right? Yes, sir. We play birthday parties and stuff like that. We even just did the opening ceremony of the new Courthouse Square in downtown Dayton, I say. What is your group called? Peanut Butter and Jelly. Kenley eyes me. He says. For the first time, it occurs to me that Peanut Butter and Jelly is probably not a very exciting name. He offers his hand. It is translucent white and utterly smooth. Good luck, son. I will keep you in mind. With my moment with the master behind me, I ride down in the elevator with my mom and two women who proceed to tell me that Mr. Kenley lives in the winter months in Florida as a woman named Joan Kenley. My mind boggles. I look up at my mom, who rolls her eyes and makes a clucking sound, which she does whenever she thinks something is entertaining but highly unacceptable. I would elicit that cluck a lot later in life. As we walk through the lobby, I see a man wheeling industrial traveling cases with the name Liza Minnelli stenciled on them. My mom lets me ask the guy what's going on. He tells me he is a road manager for Ms. Minnelli, who is giving a concert tonight. I turn back to my mom. "I want to meet Liza Minnelli," I announce. Liza has just become a superstar in cabaret. In keeping with her ethos of letting me explore the possibilities of my own life, my mom says, "Well, Robbie, why don't you try to find her?" With that, I'm off. I march right up to the front desk. "Liza Minnelli's room number, please," I say. I figure if I can meet a real actress, maybe I can learn something about how to be a real actor myself. Incredibly, the man at the desk says, "Miss Minnelli is in suite 528. Mom smiles at me and I run for the elevators. In a moment, I'm standing outside of the suite. I knock as if it's the most natural thing on earth, as if she would be expecting me. In most other areas of my life, I am slightly behind the curve, retiring, sometimes unsure. But when it comes to anything to do with the dreams of being an actor, I am filled with what I would later learn is called chutzpah. I knock again. There's no response. Now I can hear the sounds of stirring behind the door, and a male voice says, "Just a minute." The door opens. A man with no shirt stands there, looking down at me. "Who are you?" "My name is Rob Lowe, and I want to be an actor, and I was hoping to meet Miss Minnelli." The shirtless man stares at me for a very long beat. "Come in," he says finally. I enter the suite. A few bottles of wine, some burnt candles, and room service remnants are scattered about.
"Liza, are you awake? You have a visitor."
He leads me to the living room. Liza is propped up on the couch, eating chocolates and drinking wine.
"Well, hello there, kiddo," she says in her unique,
crackly, high-ended voice. Mr. Bearchest tells her that I am a young actor who's come calling.
"Well, isn't that marvelous?"
she says, batting her incredibly long eyelashes.
"What's your name?"
I tell her, and she introduces me to the man, who turns out to be her husband, Jack Haley Jr. I have just played a munchkin in The Wizard of Oz, and here I am, with Judy Garland's daughter and the Tin Man's son. Liza asks me to sit and offers me one of her chocolates. Gracious and warm, she doesn't seem to mind for a minute that I've intruded on her privacy. Faced with this proximity to a true superstar at the height of her fame, I'm tongue-tied, but she draws me out, chatting with me about theater and music and asking me questions about myself. It's surreal. When I sense it's time to go, I thank them for letting me come say hi, and she kisses me on the cheek.
"Good luck. Maybe I'll see you someday in Hollywood," she smiles and winks at Jack Haley Jr.
"Yeah, kid, see you in Hollywood," he says.
As I say goodbye, there is no way of knowing that, in fact, I will see them both again in Hollywood. The effect famous people can have on other people's lives is not to be underestimated. They can inspire us with their talent, make us feel like kings with their kindness, with a hello, a handshake, or an autograph. They seem like creatures from another race with supernatural abilities. And true stars understand that. Liza Minnelli certainly did. When you're around them, the ones at the top of their game, there's always the possibility that some of their magic could rub off on you. One day I hear that Telly Savalas from Kojak is coming to Dayton. Kojak is the biggest thing on TV, although, truth be told, I prefer The Partridge Family and reruns of Lost in Space. That said, if Telly Savalas is going to be in Dayton, I want to meet him. It is a brutal, gray, dark winter day, and the wind whips through my CPO jacket as I walk to the bus stop for the journey downtown to Reich's department store. I take the bus everywhere these days, sometimes transferring between a number of different routes. It never occurs to me that I'm often the only kid traveling alone. I love the freedom and the sense of adventure. It's Christmas time, so Reich's is busy as I screw around riding the escalators backwards for a while before following the signs that say, "TV's Kojak, Telly Savalas, live, fourth floor today." I have no idea why Telly Savalas is in Dayton on the fourth floor of Reich's, and I really don't care. I'm just thrilled to see this well-known actor in the flesh. The line for Telly Savalas wraps around the men's clothing department and into the women's handbags. I take my place and begin to wait, thinking of what I want to ask him. How did he get his start? Is acting fun? What's Hollywood like? I know that on his TV show, he's famous for always having a lollipop in his mouth, so I've brought him one of my favorites, a Charms Blow Pop, as a gift. As I move forward in the line, I can see him, sitting behind a sort of card table, signing 8x10 photos for each person who steps forward. It's almost my turn now, and although I've been in the line for almost an hour, my excitement hasn't waned. An aide leans in to whisper something to Telly Savalas, who looks up and smiles at the man, relief clearly visible on his face. The man moves to the front of the line and cuts it off with a red velvet rope. "That's it, folks. Thanks for coming." Savalas bolts like a rocket. He's gone, out of sight, somewhere between the kitchenware and the women's handbags. There's a murmur of upset from the remaining crowd in line. I am third from the front and deeply disappointed, but I understand how busy Mr. Savalas must be. I'm sure he has to get back to Hollywood and to Kojak. "Excuse me, sir," I say to the aide. "I have a gift for Mr. Savalas." I fumble in my pocket and offer up my charm's blow pop to the man. "Would you please give it to him? I know he likes lollipops." The man looks at me and smiles. "Sure, kid," he says. I hand him the lollipop and turn to go. I figure that even though I didn't meet Telly Savalas, I saw a great actor in the flesh and witnessed what it's like to be adored by fans and the excitement that ripples around a star's appearance. I turn around for one last look. I see the aide to Mr. Savalas throw my lollipop in the trash can. Around this time, my mom and Bill begin to fight almost nightly. Chad is too young to know the slippery slope that this can lead us down. With the day in the lumberyard seared in my memory, I am anxious and scared each night as they scream below my bedroom. I develop a way to mask the yelling and pounding noises so I can sleep. I discover that if I shake my leg in a certain way, it vibrates the bed frame and creates a metallic shaking noise that drowns out any other sound. Soon, I can't fall asleep without my leg-shaking trick, and it becomes a tick that will stay with me for many years. As their marriage deteriorates, so does my mother's health. She's in bed a lot, and yet I'm never told exactly what is wrong. She can be her normal, interested, interesting, supportive self one day, and mysteriously incapacitated the next, adding to the volatility in the house and to my ever-present sense that something bad could happen at any minute. I escape by bus to the theater and throw myself into any play I can find, like Oklahoma, The Time of Your Life, and Stop the World I Want to Get Off. What an apropos title for me. My dad, always the one looking to have fun and make sure we did the same, arranges for me to appear on a local cable access kids show, Clubhouse 22. I watched it for years and loved the host, a hip guy named Malcolm, and his sidekick, Duffy the Dog. Walking into the television studio, I feel an electric charge I still get sometimes today. The bright lights, the smell of paint and freshly cut wood, the thrilling disconnect between fantasy and reality that you feel when you behold a TV or movie set and its unique mixture of beautiful fakery and practical, unexpected reality. On the air, I help Malcolm and Duffy the Dog pick the prize winner from a mailbag. And I'm shocked when Duffy later removes his giant dog head to reveal a very beautiful blonde woman. Years later, when I discover that my dad has been secretly banging Duffy the Dog, I don't think I've ever been more proud. If that's the connection that got me onto my first set, so much the better. I'd also finally found a gang of neighborhood kids to hang out with, building forts, throwing mud balls, and playing tackle football. Although they thought I was a freak for my acting, we bonded over our love of the Pittsburgh Steelers, Pete Rose, and the Big Red Machine, and ignored our differences, like their proclivity for petty theft and the killing and eating of neighborhood squirrels. I often found skinned, bloody squirrel bodies in my friend's kitchen sink. His family was from Appalachia. Briar is the pejorative for them. And squirrel meat is a traditional food source. It was all very deliverance. Soon, Mom was pregnant again. And, in keeping with my tradition of harsh judgments on such matters, I thought, "Pregnant? You're so old." She was 33. Micah was born that summer, and I hoped it would make our house less volatile. It didn't. My mom and Bill repainted their bedroom walls black-brown. Even an 11-year-old knows that this cannot be a good sign. The thing was, I had a good relationship with my stepfather, and I wanted their marriage to last. Bill and I listened to talk radio, cheered Senator Irvin at the Watergate hearings, did door-to-door campaigning for everyone from George McGovern to Senator Howard Metzenbaum. When Micah was a couple years old, my mother began to retreat to her bedroom for hours a day, every day. She wrote short stories and poems and kept a daily journal, which she would do for the rest of her life. But her mysterious illness was gaining a grip on her. She began to feel that Chad was also suffering from what she thought were allergies. And so she checked Chad and herself into the country's leading hospital for universal allergics, Henrotin Hospital in downtown Chicago. They were there to fast, having nothing but water for 2 weeks, then eat nothing but blueberries. The doctors would see how they reacted. Another fast would follow, and another single food would be introduced, each more exotic than the next, culminating in caribou meat. Chad, 7 years old and feeling perfectly fine, was terrified. But off he went. The first passenger on the first of my mother's grand expeditions into the rising dawn of self-fulfillment, self-help, and self-obsession. Upon their release from the Universal Allergy Hospital, both my mom and Chad seemed exactly the same. What had changed was our refrigerator. It was now stocked with buffalo and caribou meats, and we were regimented to drinking special water. We consumed handfuls of vitamins that made me want to vomit. Chad and I looked forward to our weekends when we both got to be with our dad and gorge on hamburgers, milkshakes, and pizza. Not surprisingly, on those carefree weekends, Chad felt great. I'm playing Nerf football with my friends in the mud and slush of a mild winter day. It's tackle, as usual, and we light into each other without fear of injury, absolutely hammering each other. This is the daily ritual for our gang of friends. Football in the cold, kick the can when it's warm, huge games with kids everywhere. I've got my uniform, a breakaway Steelers jersey over a sweatshirt and Levi Toughskins. I see my mom on the porch waving me in. Gotta go, guys. Come on, Lo, just a few more plays. You pussy, they yell at me good-naturedly. And I'm happy that in spite of our backgrounds, we've become such good friends. I lope down the block to my house. I cannot remember the specifics of what happens next. I have spent hours, days, even years trying. It's like the Rosemary Woods 20-minute gap of the Watergate tapes of my childhood. I've come to realize that the first divorce and subsequent move was painful enough to block the second one out of my long-term memory. But the facts are clear enough. Mom and Bill are over. My mom will make us forsake Ohio and its gray, unhealthy winters for a move to California. She has friends there that she met while in the allergy hospital. Unlike the conversation in the lumberyard, I have only vignetted memories of this entire chapter of my life. Clearly, I have learned my lesson well. I would black out, avoid, disassociate any and everything beyond my comfort level. Saying goodbye to my home, my friends, my dad, Bill, my grandparents, to leave for a place I had never been or seen was just too tough for me to process properly. Years later, I would learn the filmmaking phrase for my random, isolated memories. It's called a montage. Cue the music, Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, as I kiss my grandparents and hop into the packed car. Bill's not there. He is gone, unable to watch, saying his goodbyes and hugging us boys in the middle of the night. My football gang is there, too. The kids of the great hardscrabble North Dayton families. The Freemans, the Scarpellis, the Eiferts. They run alongside the car as we pull away. I want to jump out, tell my mom, don't do this, don't make us go, I'm scared. I want to stay here with my friends, but I say nothing. I'm frozen inside. My brothers and I watch as our friends begin to stop running, falling by the wayside, unable to keep up, as our car speeds off into the distance. Chapter 4. I have never seen so many cars in my life. Our Volvo station wagon is stopped dead in the middle of the biggest, busiest freeway I have ever seen. It's 80 degrees in the middle of winter, and the sky is the color of a baseball mitt. To my left, 8 guys in a pickup are blasting accordion music like what you might hear at a circus. To my right is a trailer hauling cars. One of them is the Batmobile. Welcome to Los Angeles, kid. My mom navigates the traffic jam as best she can with little Micah crawling like an ape around the car trying to remove the oxygen mask she's taken to wearing. Her new hero, Dr. Wilson of the allergy hospital, has prescribed the mask and a number of other remedies as a way to prevent allergy flare-ups. The horrific brown LA air suggests that the oxygen mask might be a sound idea, but I have no clue why she is also wearing thick white gardening gloves. Later, I will learn that they supposedly protect her hands from toxic outgassing from the plastic steering wheel. Now, out the window, I can see the Pacific Ocean. It is rugged, crashing, and huge. A sign says, "Welcome to Malibu, 22 miles of scenic beauty." I'm feeling a queasy mixture of homesickness and gurgling excitement beholding the stunning alien world. Point Doom sits at the westernmost edge of Malibu. A breathtaking, palisaded promontory, it looks like a sawed-off volcano, jutting its jagged cliffs into the crashing surf below. Named after the Spanish missionary, Father Dumetz, who cowed the local Chumash Indians into Christianity, it is rumored to be haunted, and stories of ancient burial grounds and lost underwater villages are legend. At the moment, I am unaware of this unsettling history, although within months I will begin to see the signs everywhere. But as we turn into the cul-de-sac of our modest ranch-style house, I only know that my mom has chosen Point Doom because it has the best air quality in Southern California. Our new house is a rented, single-story ranch house, very plain, with three bedrooms, one bath, and a yard strewn with what looks to be small moon rocks. Chad and I will come to despise this yard, as we will have to weed it of intruding crabgrass every weekend before we can go out to play. But the real showstopper is the tiny horse corral, which Mom tells Chad and me was constructed with leftover wood from the set of Planet of the Apes. I can almost look down the gully behind it to see the beach where Charlton Heston discovered the remains of the Statue of Liberty in one of filmmaking's most iconic scenes. There's also an unsubstantiated rumor that the captain and Tennille may have lived in our house. I'm quickly sensing that on Point Doom, there is adventure as well as Hollywood history at every turn. An entire book could and should be written about Malibu in 1976. In the bicentennial sunlight of that year, it was a place of rural beauty where people still rode to the local market on horseback and tied up to a hitching post in the parking lot. Long before every agent and studio president knocked down the beach shacks to build their mega mansions, Malibu was populated by a wonderful mix of normal working-class families, hippies, asshole surfers, drugged-out reclusive rock stars, and the odd actor or two. The town was extremely Spartan. Its lone movie theater only got films months after they had played everywhere else. Its one record shop wouldn't have the latest record for weeks and weeks after you could find it all over Los Angeles. There was a taco stand, a donut shop, a biker bar, and one or two restaurants in all of its 22 miles. Although Hollywood was only a 45-minute drive away, at the time, it might as well have been 45 light years. It's almost impossible now to imagine a Malibu without Wolfgang Puck, Nobu Sushi, Starbucks, and the paparazzi documenting every B-list celebrity who walks out the door with a latte, but it did exist once upon a time. As I'm settling into my new bedroom, which I will share with Chad, my mom tells me she has a surprise in the other room. Chad is convinced it's a puppy. He and I run into the living room, excited to see what she has in store for us. It isn't a puppy. From behind a stack of boxes emerges a dark-haired, dark-eyed man with a black beard. Think of the guys in the box of Mr. Smith's cough drops. Chad gasps. Dr. Wilson? Hey, Chaddo, he says, beaming. I look around the room. Dr. Wilson? The allergy hospital guy? What's he doing here? How do you like the surprise? My mom asks cheerily, as if she's just presented us with a new jungle gym or, indeed, a puppy. Hey, Robbo, he adds warmly. Steve is going to be living with us, Mom announces. I look at her. She is beaming, happy. After taking a moment to digest the announcement, Chad seems to be down with the program as well. And in a testament to the simplicity and resilience of 12-year-olds, I take a minute to process this instant addition to our family and conclude, sounds okay to me. Can I have the bed by the window? Later that night, as I sleep in my new room, I think about what's become of our family. I'm desperately homesick for my dad and grandparents. I wonder if my friends are playing football without me. I consider my mother. She must be a brave person to leave an unhappy marriage when so many other people of her background just stick it out. I figure she is to be admired for following her heart and doing what she thought was right for both herself and us boys. As the beautifully pungent aroma of night-blooming jasmine wafts through my window, I begin to see my mother in a new way. A rebel. An artist. A dreamer. A searcher. And I'm sad for her, too. Worried because I have no idea what she's searching for. And fear that neither does she. Dr. Wilson, or Steve, as we now call him, is an intellectual, awkward, kooky, but nice guy. He and my mom have a deep connection. They spend hours reading Carl Jung, Steve is now working in L.A. County's mental health department as a shrink, listening to Phoebe Snow, eating hummus, and rubbing each other's feet. He treats Chad and Micah and me well, and I'm relieved to see Mom happy and out of her pajamas for long stretches of time. As our first day of school approaches, Chad and I haven't seen many other kids. There are no pickup football games, no kids riding bikes in the street, no sounds of yelling, roughhousing, and mischievous camaraderie between the houses. Chad and I wander aimlessly looking for people our own age. Eventually, I will learn that this is very different from the Midwest, where kids connect with each other via big communal activities like kick the can or street hockey. Malibu kids are isolated, solitary by nature, and when amongst their peers, they form small, extremely tight cliques. The surfers, the burnouts, the brains, the nerds. There are also those who seem like ghosts, not belonging to anyone or any clique. The Lost Boys of Malibu. And indeed, their tragic narrative of freak accidents and death will play itself out throughout my teen years on Point Doom, lending credence to the stories of its haunted past. My first day of seventh grade at Malibu Park Junior High begins with me getting on a bus and sitting next to a kid I think I might be able to befriend. But then he gives me a look that makes me feel like an idiot for not sitting in the empty seat behind him or in front of him. I make a mental note of the Malibu bus protocol. Never again will I sit next to someone unless every other seat is taken. Things don't get any better upon my arrival at school. Kids snicker at my clothes. I've worn my favorite Levi Tough Skins, not knowing that no one wears long pants to school, ever, under any circumstances. In the classroom, I'm eager and interested, which is also frowned upon. The cool kids sit in the back of the class in their shorts and flip-flops and talk about surfing until the teacher tells them to shut up. I begin to watch the clock, hoping that PE will be different, but I get no break there either. I'm hoping for flag football or baseball or kickball, but get volleyball instead. Not a lot of volleyball in Ohio. I suck, and everybody notices. At lunch, a group of kids asks me what I'm into. I tell them I want to be an actor. They stare at me. If I thought being 45 minutes outside of Hollywood would make that concept acceptable, I was wrong. "Are you a fag?" one of the girls asks me. The others laugh, and my face turns bright red. A shaggy, blonde-haired surfer grabs the cute girl by the ass. "Who's a fag? This guy?" he says, looking at me and pulling her in for a kiss. The other kids ooh and ah at this overt show of sexuality, and I use the distraction to make my escape back to my locker. Finally, school is over. I board the bus home and find an empty seat away from everyone else. Over the next few days, I begin to get the drill. Although my bus stop is first and the bus is always empty, I am not to sit in the back rows. If I were to attempt that, the ripped blonde leader of the cool set, a surfer named Peter, would have me forcibly removed. That area of the bus and other specific areas of the grass, where we have lunch, are the sole domain of the volleyball stars, surf champs, and their girlfriends. I eventually find my place in this Darwinian landscape, where I probably then rightfully belong, with the nerds and the other pleasures to have in class. One day, as I'm killing time hanging out at the Mayfair Market parking lot, I see a bunch of kids running around in army outfits. They seem to be playing some sort of war game and are taking it very seriously. I ask the kid who looks to be the leader what's going on. He is a chunky blonde with a runny nose that he doesn't bother to wipe. He tells me that he is filming a Vietnam movie and that he is using the market's loading dock as a set. He shows me his 8mm movie camera and introduces himself. "I'm Chris Penn. I'm the director." Now this is exciting. Kids shooting their own movie. I ask him who else is in this movie, hoping he will ask me to be in it as well. "Well, I've got my best friend Charlie, my brother Sean, and maybe Charlie's big brother Emilio." "You mean you guys are actors too?" I ask. I already know that none of these kids are in the cool crowd. They don't surf. "Nah, not really. We just like making movies. Charlie's dad is an actor, though." "Holy shit, a real actor?" I ask. "Yeah, he's done a bunch of movies. Can I meet him?" Chris laughs. "Are you kidding? He's been gone almost 2 years, working overseas on a film about war somewhere in the Philippines." Later I learn the movie's called Apocalypse Now, and his name is Martin Sheen. But at this moment, I think to myself, now that's a guy I'd like to meet someday. Chris tells me that when they make another movie, he'll call me, but for now, we don't have any parts for you. I stick around and watch as they film each other getting shot in every conceivable fashion, slapping ketchup everywhere for fake blood. The Mayfair market is Vietnam. The magic of Hollywood. At home later, Chad has exciting news as well. His elementary school is being used the next day for filming of a TV series. I can't believe it. My intense loneliness and longing for my father and friends back in Dayton begins to fade into the background. This place isn't so bad after all. The previous week at my brother's elementary school, Chad's teacher hid a kid in the class closet so he wouldn't be kidnapped in an ugly custody dispute. As the kid's mom and a team of lawyers scoured the school, the sheriff was called to rescue the poor kid, who was ensconced like Anne Frank in the broom closet of the art room. The father arrived as well, and the staff oohed and aahed as he was a legendary rock icon, but the kids were more excited to see the sheriffs running around with their guns drawn. The incident was soon forgotten. If the same thing happened today, it would have been on TV and in the tabloids for weeks. I rush home from school to stand with Chad watching a TV crew convert the principal's office into a hospital emergency room with the help of giant lights and a caravan of equipment and trucks. People are crowding around to get a glimpse of the three actresses as they repeatedly enter and exit the emergency room. They shoot the scene over and over, and to us it's riveting each time. The three stars take a break and walk to their chairs. On the front of each are their names, Jacqueline Smith, Kate Jackson, and Farrah Fawcett. And on the background, a cartoon-like logo of them holding guns and the title, Charlie's Angels. Unlike Liza Minnelli, these gals have flocks of people surrounding them. There's no way to get close, but eventually I strike up a conversation with someone on the TV crew. He looks important to me. He's hauling a lot of cables and lights and listening to a walkie-talkie. I ask him a barrage of questions, culminating with the classic, "How do you think I get into acting?" And the man tells me I should write to the producer of Charlie's Angels, Aaron Spelling. He's the biggest producer in the history of television. "I'm sure he would like to hear from you," the man says with a smile. So I run home and compose a letter to Mr. Spelling. It takes some time to find an address for him, but I finally do, care of the 20th Century Fox Studios. I drop it in the mailbox and wait for his reply. As the seventh grade came to an end, I couldn't wait to spend my appointed time back in Ohio with my dad. I would see my old friends and tell them of my California adventures, and I'd get my spot back in Peanut Butter and Jelly. It would be good to be on stage again, as I hadn't done any acting since I moved to California. My dad and my new stepmother, Kay, had a baby boy named Justin about a week before Chad and I arrived. We all shared a room, and Chad and I took turns giving him bottles. I was happy to be back with this branch of my family, but could have done without having a screaming baby as an alarm clock. When I called the man who ran Peanut Butter and Jelly, he told me the group wasn't doing any performances at the moment, and that there was nothing on the horizon. It was strange. I had known this man for years and had never heard him use this kind, patient, and encouraging tone of voice with me. It would take me years of working in Hollywood to recognize this truth. When someone in the entertainment business, even in Dayton, Ohio, uses this tone with you, 9 times out of 10, they're lying. And indeed he was. Peanut Butter and Jelly was playing all around Dayton. They just didn't want me back. After a month, Chad and I returned to Malibu, and only then did I realize I was already beginning to prefer it to Dayton. Malibu summers were epic. Each day was cookie-cutter consistent, 80 degrees and sunny, no thick Midwestern humidity, and no rain ever. I had made some friends, and we would spend endless hours exploring the mysterious overgrown gullies that ran to the ocean and body surfing in crystal waves that made Malibu famous. A ninth grade girl had taken an interest in me, and I often rode my bike to her house to fool around with her. Like Julie the Jitterbug, she took great pleasure in teaching me the finer points of what my parents would probably call heavy petting. She was not, by any means, one of the girls of the popular set. In fact, I took a lot of shit for being linked with her, which seemed unfair to both her and me. We were both misfits in a way, which made us a good match. And let's face it, when a ninth grader is interested in a seventh grader, it's pretty cool. As the summer drew to a close, I somehow got invited to the birthday party of the Queen Bee of the Malibu Park Junior High in crowd. A stunning blonde, sometime teen model, and surf goddess. pulling out of the driveway, I had my mom stop to check the mailbox, as was my custom since I wrote my letter to Aaron Spelling. It had been well over 6 months, but I still held out hope. And today, amazingly enough, I was rewarded. "Dear Rob, I was happy to receive your letter. You seem like a very nice young man, and I would welcome you to visit me at the studio anytime, providing it's fine for your parents. Please call ahead, though. Sincerely, Aaron Spelling. P.S. I have a funny feeling you might have my job one day." I was floored. It was on 20th Century Fox stationery. It was better than a letter from President Ford, as at the moment Spelling was probably more powerful and popular than Ford. At the party, no one cared. The cool kids of the 7th and 8th grade were much more focused on the top-secret gift the birthday girl was sharing with everyone. It was a tiny, amber-colored bottle with a black lid filled with some sort of white powder. I asked Peter the Surfer what it was. "It's coke, you idiot." I didn't know what he meant, but knew enough to get that it was clearly a drug of some sort. By then, I was used to seeing kids smoke pot. A number of them brought their parents' water pipes to school and often set up a rudimentary bazaar on the lawn at lunch where the devices were traded and sold. But this was different. And since I was an outsider anyway, no one invited me to join them in the amber-colored bottle in the bathroom. I never told my mom or Steve what I saw at the party. Parents were rarely seen in Malibu. The kids lived Lord of the Flies style, running their own programs without any interference from an adult ever. And so, like any good chameleon, I began to do the same. And Mom and Steve were perfectly happy to let me and my brother have the freedoms that would be unimaginable today. Chad and I would take the bus 25 miles to Santa Monica alone, catch three other connections for the additional 15 miles through the wasteland of downtown Los Angeles to go to Dodger games. At one such game, a group of fans got belligerent with Chad for wearing a Yankees hat, even though we were Cincinnati Reds fans. Things were getting ugly when a guy stepped in and rescued my brother and me from the mob. Turns out he was a Yankee fan himself. We thanked him profusely, and he just laughed and said, "You're cool kids. Maybe you want to come and visit me at work. I'm a head puppeteer on the Muppets." "The Muppets? Hell yes, we like to visit the Muppets," we exclaimed. And so, a few weeks later, we did. It was my first time on a soundstage. As Mom and Steve drove us through the guard gate, I felt a rush of adrenaline, a stirring so profound I almost felt lightheaded. I was entering the inner sanctum of movie making, my first step into a world I wanted so much to be a part of. On the set, we watched Frank Oz perform Miss Piggy. The legendary Jim Henson himself sat on his director's chair with Kermit the Frog on his right hand. They were shooting a beautiful and strangely sad musical number called The Rainbow Connection, for what was to be known as the Muppet Movie. Our new friend from the Dodger game, Richard, operated Scooter. A few weeks later, we got another invitation from Richard. For the first and, I think, only time in the show's history, a puppet would fill in for Johnny Carson as host of The Tonight Show. Kermit the Frog would have the honors, and we were invited to be in the audience. Obviously, we went. Backstage, after the taping of the show, there was a small party. A gregarious man with a Santa-like beard greeted me and introduced himself.
"I'm Bernie Brillstein. I produce The Muppet Show. I hope you have a good time."
A full 20 years later, he would not only become my manager, but a surrogate father as well. Bernie also represented all the cast of the new hot show, Saturday Night Live. At the time, I repeated the entire content of each show every Sunday morning, verbatim, to my nonplussed mother. I worshiped Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase. I even won the Malibu Park Junior High School talent show with my own version of Aykroyd's classic sketch Bass-O-Matic that year. So, the sight of John Belushi staring at me from across the party froze me in my shoes. This time there would be no going over to him and striking up a conversation. He was the biggest thing on television, and I was way too intimidated. But Belushi kept staring.